Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squepakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squepak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, these days, there is an awakening interest, born very much from necessity, in the practices, principles, and values that have guided our Indigenous friends and neighbors in their very long-term and generally very successful relationship with natural ecosystems. It's a relationship that has much to teach the rest of us as we grapple with the perils of human-made climate change, pollution, species and habitat loss, environmental and social injustice, and the many other disruptive byproducts of colonialism and its handmaiden extractivist capitalism. These days, it's even more important to look for better ways to conduct ourselves because young people around the world are scanning their probable future with increasing anxiety and trepidation, and at times, a sense of betrayal. Today, we're delighted to welcome back a guest who's joined us several times, in fact, three previous times, before to discuss these and related salient topics. Dr. Keith Williams is an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. He has deep personal roots in North American indigenous culture, as his father was Tiendanaga Mohawk, but he also has deep roots in academia with a bachelor's degree in agriculture, a master's degree in mycology, the study of mushrooms, and a PhD in educational studies. Keith, it's wonderful to have you back with us on Food Conversation. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Warren. It's a pleasure to be back.
Back again and again. Either we lack imagination or you're just such a brilliant guest, we can't have enough of you.
I don't know.
I know. You're going to say, no. You must be thinking about something else. Something else. Yeah. No, it's lovely to have you back and sort of catch you in media res, you know, in the middle of things, one of the things you told me before we came on air was that you had 18 papers in process, as well as three or four that are listeners. Keith is now holding his hand over his face and thinking, who am I? What have I done? But that's a lot of work. I mean, you must feel busy.
It's too much. But, you know, my problem is I have a really hard time saying no when interesting things come up. I mean, maybe I have a hard time saying no anyway, but definitely when interesting things come up, whether it's a research project or a new cookie recipe, it's very difficult to, you know.
Yeah, well, when you're hungry, a cookie recipe is the be all and the end all of life. The other thing that, when you were describing, we'll talk about one of the big papers that you wrote in a journal with a collaborative group in a second, but one of the things you said was, I live, work, and swim in Nova Scotia. Why did you talk about swimming? You called it daily baptism, or somebody called it that anyway. Talk about your swimming habit.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's one of several habits that I have, probably one of the better ones, healthier ones. But, you know,
we won't talk about the other ones.
No, work is one of the other ones.
Right.
But with the swimming, you know, it's one of these things I never really thought that I would get so into it. But here we are. And, you know, really, it's interesting. I was inspired to really, pardon the pun, jump into the deep end.
It's very deep too.
I know. Actually, at times, yeah.
Yeah.
By my friend Buffy Turner, who's Cherokee and Black American, she founded the Food Sovereignty is Indigenous Sovereignty Facebook group.
Okay.
And and she's very much an Atlantic person, that's her thing. And so you know, over the years, you know, we'd had, you know, a number of conversations about the ocean, and I was really like inspired by the extent to which, she really connected with, particularly with the Atlantic. And I think, as someone with Cherokee roots and also someone whose ancestors came across the Atlantic as part of the, the slave trade, she, her relationship with the Atlantic is, fraught
complex.
And, yeah, complex and profound.
Yeah.
And so I was so inspired by that. And, and I live, I live really close to the ocean, or at least the Minas Basin, which is part of the Bay of Fundy.
Okay.
And so we have the highest and lowest tides in the
world.
Oh,
heavens,
here.
The Bay of Fundy. It's famous.
It is, yeah.
Very famous.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, what I thought to myself, what that means is that, my swimming times are quite limited. So
I was going to say, you got to be careful, otherwise you'll disappear.
It's true. I can only go, there are typically, there may be two high tides in a day.
Yeah,
and that's when I can go. And usually one of them is in the middle of the night. but of course it varies, right? Because it varies according to the moon cycle.
Correct.
So for me, the thing with swimming, I could probably talk for hours about swimming, but I'll just say one thing, and that's, well, two things maybe, just quickly. And one of them is that, it allows me to attend to a form of nonlinear time.
Mm-hmm,
so it kind of helps me to reorient my relationship with time, because I think, too often we're subjected to and made subjects from, the linear clock,
yes.
which is really, artificial and of
totally
course
artificial.
To be an
Absolutely.
Revolution. Yeah. And so that's one thing. And so, I guess it really helps me to do that. And the other thing that I find really, meaningful and interesting, and I'm just pointing and hoping that this will happen. I've heard these stories from, well, I haven't heard them from older people from around here, but I've heard them from people who've heard them from older people from around here. So I don't know what, this is a bit of a telephone game, but the story goes something like this. These folks who particularly live in on the other side of the Minas Basin near Parsbro, they could be miles inland cutting wood or picking berries or whatever, and yet they can still feel the high tide, the movement of the tides,
oh, really?
in their bones, and I mean metaphorically,
even physically. I mean,
transubstantiation. their bodies. Their bodies,
sure.
And I just think, wow, why can't we have that? We can have this. We can have this in our lives, And I think this is coming back to our humanity, really. And so that's kind of what I'm hoping for anyway. I want to be more human. Some days I really don't feel it. But,
then you jump in the ocean. I was thinking
and I'm reborn.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure which side of Nova Scotia would be plunging into, but in the ocean but obviously the Bay of Fundy, one of the things you said was every day in that same introduction in the article that I'm referring to, you said, and every day Keith is amazed at the tides in the Bay of Fundy. And I was thinking, okay, there's something going on here. Well, it's part and parcel of recognizing that the powers of nature are all supreme, and we need to attach ourselves to them rather than get in with a shovel and start digging them up and playing around with them. I don't know.
Well, exactly. And, I feel so lucky to be so close to such a dramatic and powerful, powerful example of that force of nature. And I think in a way, I think it's so much easier to feel that and to engage with that when it's so powerful.
Yes.
So I'm very lucky that way. And if it were more subtle, it might be more difficult.
Yes, I know.
For me,
getting
I don't know.
No, for all of us, Keith, getting hit over the head with a club is something really attention getting rather than being tickled under the chin. I thought we could start off with some concepts that are central to Indigenous thinking. And as I was making some notes for today, I was actually thinking over my desk at home for quite some time now. I've had a three-ring Venn diagram. I don't know who Venn was, but he or she has got their name on this thing. Three circles that overlap. And they're from a book which I'm sure you're very familiar with, Medicine Wheel for the Planet, by Jennifer Grenz. Another doctor, Dr. Jennifer Grenz. And the three circles represent reciprocity, respect, and responsibility. Would you like just to meditate a little bit on those three essential principles from Indigenous thinking about our relationship with the natural world?
Okay. Well, yeah, no, that those are what important orienting principles. And I mean, you know, when I think about respect, maybe we could start with responsibility, if
sure.
That's okay.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that my elder, and I would even call him a mentor, you know, in the mainstream world, the Western world, you know, we're increasingly concerned with our rights. Like, this is something, it's typically, you know, we frame our relationship with the state in terms of rights. And those rights are seen as individual rights.
Human rights.
And what's missing from that particular, exactly, human rights. And you know, what's missing from that conversation, well, two things, and you just helped me to remind me of a second one. The first is responsibilities. And our responsibilities to creation, and the second one is that focus on the human. And you know, it's interesting. I was down in New York City recently, and I went, and it was okay. I was a little bit worried about it. I canceled a subsequent trip to the U.S.,
yes.
But I did go to New York, and one of the conference organizers, Cesar Rodriguez Garavito. He's a professor at NYU Law, and he said, you know, he used to be very interested in human rights, but now he's not anymore. He's interested in more than human rights that encompass the rights of, you know, plants and animals and rivers and mountains, because for him, and I thought this is quite brilliant. Human rights, of course, are encompassed by more than human rights.
Indeed.
So why not just tackle the whole thing?
Yeah.
You know,
the whole enchilada.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So responsibility, and then respect and reciprocity.
Okay. Yeah. You know, reciprocity. I'm going to leave the respect one till last, because I'm not quite sure what to say about that. But reciprocity. Maybe I'll think of something between now and then. But reciprocity is an interesting one, you know, and a lot of people talk about that these days. Like, it's on the tip of everyone's tongue, it seems, you know, and especially in the context of Indigenous settler relations. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, the whole reciprocity thing, like, I think when that notion is translated into a kind of the Western mind or the Western thought process, it's often viewed in very transactional terms.
Yes.
You know, like, I give you, you know, I'll mow your lawn and you'll bake me a cake or whatever, or cookies, maybe cookies.
It's just cookies will do.
And so I think, you know, of course, this is very much part of how humans, whether you're Indigenous or not, how humans interact with one another. You know, there's often a very direct and reciprocal exchange, and there's nothing wrong with that. But in a sense, that kind of exchange, whether it's for money or goods or services or what have you, whether it's, you know, framed in terms of the cash economy or bartering, it's still underlying that is still this ethos that frames the kind of the capitalist endeavor or the capitalist project. Yeah. And so, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
We're working for each other, but we're not thinking of why we're doing this. I just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Dr. Keith Williams, who is an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. So we've left respect to the last. What is inherent in Indigenous lore and thinking and principles that embodies and enlivens respect?
And would it be okay if I just quickly return to reciprocity
second? Let's clean up reciprocity.
Sure, just for a sec. And so I think, you know, there's this fantastic, I'll make a book recommendation for yourself and all the listeners. It's Lewis Hyde's, what's it called? It's The Gift. I think that's what it's called, The Gift. And Lewis Hyde is an American essayist who's written a number of very interesting books. And so this book is about gift logic. And so I think really, like, not to belittle or diminish the importance of direct transactional reciprocity, but I think, I'm more interested in a much deeper form of reciprocity, which is that notion, indigenous notion of gift, the gift. And it extends, of course, even beyond the indigenous world. And I think women's child rearing practices are probably a prime example of the gift. And so the idea is that, one would give without the expectation to receive in return. And it's like a pay it forward sort of thing,
Well, it also seems to me that it embodies a different understanding of what the natural world around us is all about. And the two terms that come to my mind are the difference between a gift and a resource. A resource, resource extraction. I mentioned extractivist capitalism and colonialism. It's just the assumption that all these things were put out there as instruments for our own satisfaction, and we can exploit them at our leisure or with the intensity we choose, just because they're there. Mother Nature has given them to us as a gift, where you don't have to pay anything back. You just take the gift, have fun with it, do whatever you want. You know, the Epcot Center, Disney World view of the way we relate to the world is out there giving us things. We take them and we do them what we will. And Mother Nature doesn't really count. She's just this giant breadbasket that we can grab a loaf out of every time we want to, and that's it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, it's interesting, if I could return for a second to your use of the word resource, because I think, that is kind of, when I was doing my master's degree, there were other people doing masters in natural resource management. And, people talk about that a lot in BC. I know, exactly. And, I have the same reaction. I start to feel my windpipe kind of constricting as soon as, my bile rising, when people
as a,
say
as
resource.
A physician, I understand exactly what you're talking about now.
Yeah. And as a person too, because I can see you have probably a similar reaction.
I did indeed.
As a physician and human, and I just think, it's like, but at the same time, like, and I try to avoid using that term because of the, what I view as the extractivist and pejorative kind of connotations.
For sure.
But when we look at that word, embedded in that word is like, it's like essentially means returning to the source.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And la source in French also is the word for spring.
Yes.
And like a
water source.
A natural spring.
Yeah.
And so I just wonder, like, some of these words, like, I just wonder, like the way they've been misused, is there any hope for reclaiming this language in a good way? I don't know.
Well, there's a hope when you speak it,
right.
Humans, we use language. I've noticed recently,
and some better than others.
Yeah, we all have our strengths and our weaknesses, and it's that evolution of language, like going, for example, from a decadent forest to an old growth forest. I mean, what a change in conceptual thinking goes from saying decadent. I mean, decadent means it's broken down, it's messed up, it's like some old guy sitting in the street. Or some civilization is past its due date and is falling apart. And old growth means elder. It means expansion, but at the rate of speed that an elderly life form would expand. It's inherently far more respectful. And yet that change has taken place in forestry without people noticing. Nobody says decadent anymore. They always say old growth. Well, I was in an old growth forest, not a horrible, downtrodden, decadent, useless forest sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and etymologically, if you look at the word decadent, I'm sure it shares a root with the word decay.
Yes.
And I mean, that's,
yes,
you
it
know,
does. I'm sure it
doesn't
does.
Sound too good. You
no,
know?
It's this is problematic. Okay, you can't escape talking about respect, Keith. So
Oh, sorry, what was that? No, I'm just I'm kidding. I'm sorry. My apologies.
I hope you're kidding, because I really enjoy kidding myself too, actually.
So I do it all the time too. I fool, you know, this is how I get through life, actually.
Think of the holy fool, yeah. And you'll be okay.
Okay. Well, you know, and respect is an interesting one, and I did think of something over the past minute or two, and you know, there was a Mohawk psychiatrist by the name of Claire Brandt who passed away. I didn't actually.
Oh, Brandt. Yes.
Brandt. Yeah, Claire Brandt. Yes. And I would wish I had.
Yes.
But he's passed away, and he wrote an article years ago on the indigenous principle of non-interference. Mm. And I thought that was really interesting. And so, you know, like the way, as I understand it, and I'm no expert in anything for that matter, but as I understand it, it's like, you know, it's basically the idea of, you know, we all have our role to play, and we all, you know, we all have our lives to live. And the best thing we can do is just give people and creatures and the environment the space to realize their, you know, their path and their potential, and to support them in that if possible, but to not interfere. And it sounds so simple. But yet, I mean, when I think about, you know, all of the relationships in my life and like the past and work and everything else, it's like, you know, it's not so easy to implement, you know, and for me, it's not bad. I'm pretty good at that. I'm just good at going with the flow. But most people really struggle with that, you know, and I wonder why, you know.
You know, we were talking before the show about the fact that nothing is ever completed and nothing is ever resolved in the sense, okay, it's tied up in a bow and you can just forget about it. It's more like there's a flow of things, and you use that term as well. There's a flow of things that is constant, and, you know, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they're the same. And it's maybe a more accurate way of looking at our function in the natural world. It's always, the world around us is changing, we're always changing, life forms always evolve or devolve. There's this incessant movement. And all of the mystics have said when they look at matter, they see this incessant energy movement. So maybe we're onto something, Keith. Maybe we are, after all.
Well, I think so. And actually related to that, you know, that definitely is I think from what I've learned, foundational to Haudenosaunee ontology is this notion of the world as both dynamic and vibrant and animate.
Yes.
And so, you know, and so that constant change, I think to kind of complete that kind of thought or argument, it's like, if you impede or impair that, you're acting against the natural inclination of the universe, of creation, essentially. And so I think that's, you know, without really knowing, if I had to guess, that would be my guess as to why, like the root of that, the philosophical root of that teaching. That would be my guess. I don't know, though.
Speaking of teaching, of which you know quite a bit yourself, let's talk about original instructions, a phrase that I learned from a paper you sent to me a couple of years ago, and it's in my lexicon embedded, and I cannot extract it anymore. It's staying there forever. Talk about the original instructions and the way it shapes indigenous thought towards the natural world.
Yeah, well, that's what a great segue, because I kind of see the original instructions tied in with that whole notion of non-interference.
Yes.
And, you know, again, as I understand it, you know, the original instructions were kind of a set of guidelines that were given to all of creation.
Every life form. And what we consider inanimate life forms as well. Or inanimate forms, yes.
Exactly. And so that kind of tells us what our role is in the world. And so for example, corn, beans and squash, their role is to feed people and feed persons, you know, more broadly than human people.
Yes.
And And what we can do to support them is to make sure that they have healthy places to grow and lots of food and they're treated well and looked after and respected. And so and so and so I think, I guess again, my understanding is that, we need to do what we can to fulfill our own obligations to creation. And at the same time, if there's anything we can do to support others to meet their own obligations or their own instructions, then we should do that.
It seems to be tied in to the notion of sacredness, meaning you don't, the crude way to put it is Mother Nature bats last. That's a little tagline that some of my email colleagues have added in. But the basic principle is that if things are sacred, then you must treat them with respect. You must engage in a reciprocal relationship that is meaningful and larger than just a transaction. And you have a responsibility to do that. You don't walk away from a sacred relationship. You have to remain in it and exemplify all these other qualities that we've been talking about.
Oh, totally. And it's really interesting what you said about Mother Nature bats last, because that really echoes something that that Dan Longboat said to me once. He said, you can cheat the law, you can get around, human laws, but you can't fool Mother Nature, you can't fool creation. And it's like, and eventually it'll come and it'll hit you. And when it hits you, it hits hard.
Yes.
And
Like,
he's right,
yes, saying to the police officer, "I only had two beer before I went out driving," and then you run into a tree because your brain isn't working properly. It's a whole different
exactly.
ballpark. The broad field, the broad area of the rights of nature is something that you've written about, something that is sort of an essential principle operating in our relationship with the natural world, having rights. Rights that for the longest time in Western culture were abrogated by humans, and you don't have to worry about it. Plants and animals and landforms will just do what's right for us, and that's all that really counts. And the rights of nature notion is a call to arms in addressing that selfishness.
Yeah, I agree.
I just want to remind Linson once again that we're speaking with Keith Williams, who's an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University, which is all online. What a great idea. That the sacred, the concept of sacredness, which in many human cultures is sort of restricted to certain kinds of activities, certain kinds of places, churches, mosques, It seems to me the fundamental difference in the indigenous way of looking at things is that there is no exception. There is no exception to that sacredness. And that brings in my mind, the notion of the web of life, which has been passed on to the gently flinching settler community saying, think about it a little differently. Do you want to talk about a little bit sacred rights of nature and the web that is unbroken, even if we try to break it ourselves?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a really interesting topic, and I just think, in terms of the sacred web of life, I'm actually working on an article right now with a colleague.
One of 18,
Yeah,
not
that's
colleagues,
true, actually. Yeah, it's
but
true. No, it's true. And that's with my colleague Pedro Faveron,
Ah,
who's
indeed.
Faveron. And he's a fantastic guy. He's
Yes.
I met him in Peru. I was there over the Christmas holiday, and he's a professor at La Católica, which is one of Peru's best universities. And this guy speaks five languages fluently. He
Yes.
speaks, and he and I have very deep
Including
philosophical conversations in English.
Quechua.
And Shipibo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indigenous languages way, way, way back.
Two of them. Yeah. They can speak two indigenous languages fluently. And I'm just like, wow. Like, I can hardly speak English. You know, I struggle.
But well, you're doing well, my son. You're doing very well.
Thank you. But, you know, I always appreciate, you know, working with guys like him because, you know, it kind of gives me something to aim for, you know.
Another language, another day.
Yeah. Well, you know, but yeah. So we're working on this article comparing the sacred web of life with the Internet of all things, and and we're working on that with Suzanne Brandt, who's a Mohawk knowledge keeper, and so far it's just the three of us, and we've got a good draft done. But I think the idea there is that, you know, although in some ways there are aspects, and again, we haven't fleshed this out completely, so I'm sure new insights will emerge, there are, you know, there are kind of structural similarities and functional similarities between, you know, the Internet of all things and the web of life. They're dispersed, I guess you could say irregular, and there's an element of unpredictability.
Constant shifting and change.
Yeah, so I think there's similarities, but ultimately when I look at them, and perhaps this is where your mind was going, when I look at those two webs, the interweb and the web of life, it's like, you know, one of them as a technological manifestation, of course, is rooted in, you know, Western scientific and technological thought and all the biases and assumptions that go along with that. Whereas the other one, the sacred web of life, of course, the way we conceive of that is filtered through culture. Everything is, but it's a thing unto itself rather than a human creation. And as suppose you could argue that the sacred web of life as a human creation is also something that, you know, is tied to the creator. But it's, you know, it's a step away from that. So
filtered through imperfect human consciousness, the interweb. The thing that I think is profoundly different is that we discover the web of life, the interactions among all the elements of the natural environment. Whereas with the internet and the web, we can make it and we can unmake it. We can do it with impunity. Whereas with the natural world, as you said earlier, you can't just do whatever you want. You have to listen. You have to watch. You have to touch. You have to get a sense of, and reflect on and intuit all sorts of activities that are involved with finding out what the natural world has to say, rather than saying, planning something in your mind to say, let's do this. The incredible capacity of the human mind to come up with ideas, 90% of which are cockamamie, as they would say, and that's a Scottish word that I'm sure you're familiar with, with your background on the one side of your family. But at any rate, I wanted just to kind of zone in a little bit on the fact, because this is Food Conversations, on what your thoughts are about how these values that we've been talking about can shape and I put down in my notes the word save industrial agriculture, or at least save us from being trapped in the rather artificial web that we've created of industrial agriculture and that kind of transactional relationship with the resources, which we we'll have to get spanked for that one for sure.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think these are really important points. And I would say one thing that you said kind of took me down a particular thought path, and that's that
19th paper.
Maybe it'll just be part of another one of the other ones. But you know,
yes.
But that's put you in the acknowledgments. Thank you for the inspiring chat. True. But so with that whole idea, it's like, so who are we responsible to when we're on the internet? Where is that responsibility? And you know, it's certainly not to, you know, the ecosystems that are being, you know, polluted by the server farms, you know, and whatnot, you know, yes. like I don't, I, I think because it's so dispersed, I don't know that most people feel that sense of responsibility. So I think that's what's really missing from these, highly technologized
And
environments.
isn't it true that we want to believe in their utility and value and sort of reverence them a little bit. So we hide all this stuff. We don't talk about all this stuff that is, destroying not just the natural ecosystems, but also harming us because we're part of those ecosystems. We put the facilities for the internet off in buildings and out in remote, we would call them remote places, deserts, people where there's nobody, places where people are not around in large numbers. It's like putting a nuclear power plant off in the desert rather than putting it in, your neighborhood, because we don't want to think about the awesome and terrifying implications of what we're doing, because we might not do these things if we realized all those things. If we realize what potential consequences that are harmful would actually be.
Well, and I think too, when there are other deserts associated with the internet, and it's not just those physical locations. Like, think about all the people who are harmed by activity on the internet,
Yes, indeed.
and I think particularly of gender-based violence,
Oh, yes, of course.
and I just think that's like, I think to me, what that brings up is some of anthropologist Elizabeth Povinelli's ideas around the horizon and the frontier. And so for Povinelli, it's this fantastic book called From Gaia to Ground, Four Axioms to, I don't know, something or other. But it's a really great book published, I think, by Duke University Press. And the idea is that the open futurity of the horizon is only possible because of the crimes committed at the frontier. And I mean, that's, as a formula to describe colonization
Was
and
going to say, it
colonialism,
sounds like a formula. That'll work
and
very
I mean,
nicely.
yeah, no, really, yeah.
Well, even the phrase the new world. The new world is a European phrase for, gee, we never knew these things were over here. Columbus thought, of course, he was just next door to India, and believed that in his whole life. But this idea that there's this giant playground in which, at the time, European civilization was suffering. It was at its relationship with its natural environment was terrible. Spain had a famine about every 6 or 7 years because they weren't adapting well to. They needed more germ plasm, if you like, and they got it from the New World, and that's why in Spain, major dietary components, tomatoes. Not indigenous to Spain, by golly. So if we were bringing these notions to bear on Western forms of agriculture, which are very transactional, we put the fertilizer in the ground, we put the seeds in the ground, and then we wait, and then we harvest them, and then we put them in packages and sell them, and then we make money. That kind of process. How can these values animate that process and resurrect maybe a more grounded, if I may use a term, approach to the way we just cut and run. We beat up Mother Nature and say, well, she can't talk back, so who cares? We think she can't talk back.
And it's an important question, and I just think, for me, I live in a farming village, by the ocean, but it's a farming village as well,
Of
and
800
it's
people, you told me.
Seven and change, almost eight. I guess you could round up to eight, but
We'll
yeah,
round up. We'll round up.
where I know everyone, and they all know me, and it's well, that's an exaggeration, but it's certainly a bit like that, and there are pluses and minuses, but I like it for the most part. It's a beautiful spot, and people are pretty good, but yeah, I just find like you're surrounded by agriculture, and the thing that I like about it is it's mostly food agriculture rather than feedstock agriculture. So that's good. Like one of my neighbors, Andy, he grows asparagus. He's got like, I don't know, probably 50 acres of asparagus. I
Oh
can
my
see it
goodness.
when I look out my window.
Oh, it's
So
asparagus
it's
season. My mouth is watering.
Yeah, I love it. I love
Yeah.
that stuff.
Yeah.
And interestingly, asparagus is one of these like ancient Roman crops. You know, apparently it spread throughout, the Mediterranean and West Asia during the Roman Empire. I think, getting back to your question, one of the things that I would love to see, and I'll probably be pilloried for saying this, and many other things I've written and talked about, but I think, I'd love to see agriculture being kind of abstracted from the economy. From the economic system. And so this is, I think like healthcare, it's kind of a healthy, good quality food is a human right, I believe, and a responsibility,
Yes, it's interesting on that very note, and I've said this before on Food Conversations. My profession, my beloved medical profession, does not teach students anything about food in particular. It's very rudimentary. I think they mention the word, a four-letter word, from time to time, but in terms of actually teaching the role of food in health, the fact that, for example, it's part of the 85% of things we do on a daily basis that determine our good or ill health. Food, physical activity, and our mental processes, in particular the latter. Those are the things that make people healthy or unwell. And yet we talk mostly about anatomy, physiology, and drugs and interventions where we take a sharp knife and start cutting away at people. So it's I mean, it's not that those things don't have their place. It's just that the basis, the fundamental ground floor is, in this case, one very significant part is what we put into our bodies and the relationship we have with the things that we are eventually going to put in our bodies before we've actually done so. We're out in the field, we're looking at it. You're in the field of asparagus looking at it, and you're thinking, that's Keith just looked out the window, by the way. We're thinking about more than just the fact that it's good to eat. We're thinking about how do we make it flourish? How do we encourage it to be part of our lives so we can be grateful for the fact that when we pee, we have this very unusual odor coming out of our anatomy?
Well, exactly. And it's very interesting. I feel like, one thing I really appreciate about you, Warren, is the way you kind of structure these questions. They're fantastic.
I'm hopeless. I'm hopeless. I admit
No, it's
it.
good. And so with that particular question or issue, and maybe you've got to go on break shortly, I don't know, but we've got to go on break. But with that particular issue or question, it's like I see that kind of interventionist approach to healthcare as analogous to the contemporary approach to industrial agriculture. There are
Yes.
similarities there.
Yes, very much so. I often compare the use of various pesticides to the and the overuse of them to the overuse of antibiotics, because it's very much analogous. They're very similar. Talking to people about why we don't want to overuse these precious substances that have such powerful impacts on living systems, is that if we overuse them, we misuse them. We don't want to, it's like eating too much chocolate. You get a stomach ache. It's not a good idea. Although chocolate's okay too.
Health food, it is at
Yeah, it
times.
can be health food, yes. Listeners again should know that I'm speaking with Dr. Keith Williams, who is an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. Now, there's a lot of stuff that I gathered for today's visit that we probably won't have time to get to, so that I'm probably sentences you to coming back once again, Keith. But I do want to at least touch a little bit on an article that came out in the winter issue of the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development, which you cleverly truncated to JAFSCUD or something like that. What is your how do you pronounce that complex JAFSCD acronym?
I'm not actually sure, and I didn't truncate that. It would be probably Duncan and Amy who are the editors, the main editors. It would be I would just say Jaffsid.
Okay,
Yeah, I
well,
would
I
just say that. Yeah.
but listeners should know that it's one of the very few, you might call it, scientific journals that reaches out to everybody who has something to say. So it
Yeah.
reaches out to people who are advocates. It reaches out to people who eat, which is a fairly large number of people. It reaches out to people who study and explore food systems and food and what it's all about. And they do it in the context of communities. In other words, it's not done as, you know, one person or one farm growing food. It's approaching food as an element in a community, and therefore one element that enhances community relations and makes them stronger, builds them, or does not, if it's not recognized that this is important. And you and a whole bevy of collaborative authors wrote what is described as the inaugural column by the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Editorial Circle, IFSEC. why don't you just talk about the genesis of this article? Because it really is, it and the subsequent articles related to it really kind of explores the whole world of how food and indigeneity kind of come together or can come together.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for asking, Warren. And you know that the editorial circle came about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, something like that. So we've been around for a little while, and the purpose is basically to foreground and support, elevate the work of Indigenous food system activists and scholars, Yeah, and so we partnered with FNDI, the First Nations Development Institute, and I believe they're headquartered in Colorado. And Richard Elm Hill, and he was the main person that we worked with. He's from Oneida, and really fantastic guy, a poet as well. Yeah, and the purpose of this initiative, this partnership, was to work with a handpicked group of 10 people, 10 emerging Indigenous scholars of various ages, to help mentor them to get their feet wet in the world of academic publishing. Because, as you're probably well aware, academic publishing can be pretty rough, and it's like as we would say in the academy, it's like it's a site of discursive violence, you know.
Right. So no physical weapons were used, but you're lying on the floor in a state of unconsciousness anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe metaphorically bleeding out, but it does happen. And I mean, I've seen this happen so many times to people, and it's just like the number of young scholars that I've seen who've been turned away, like who've been turned off of the academy and have left the potential of an academic career because of unkind and unproductive, unnecessarily unkind peer reviews. I mean, I could probably count those people on two hands.
And you're talking about Indigenous people who are Indigenous joining academic community in particular,
especially Indigenous people, but because of the incommensurability of worldviews. But I would say everybody, everybody, and I just think that I don't know exactly what's happening there. I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me that. Probably these are people who had experienced, harm in their own, their own academic upbringing. And then they feel like they've been patterned to inflict that on others. You could say it's a form of lateral violence in a way. Academic community.
In the introduction to the article, there's a sentence here, which I think kind of embodies that indirectly. And it says this column and the work of the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Editorial Circle reflect both our mission to work toward a more equitable and just food system, and the journal in which it's published, long-standing commitment to Indigenous food sovereignty, and they cite an article that had been written 6 years earlier. But that's what's unique about this journal, and what's unique about this. And what we're trying to talk about today, which is how Indigenous values influence or can influence, if it ever comes about, industrial agriculture, which is failing, and so it needs to be influenced, it needs to be modified and changed. And as you were preparing this article, was there a sense of kind of stepping out into a bit of a, not in this journal particularly, but in general, to the world of thought and thinking how we live in the world, that you were stepping out into a place that's been a bit of a void over the years. It just hasn't been acknowledged or even encouraged to be acknowledged.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And you know, what's interesting to me too is that, you know, we Duncan and I think Richard helped with this too. But anyway, Duncan
these
and
the
I
editors
for sure,
of the journal.
Yeah, Duncan Hilchey is the editor in chief, and Duncan and Amy, who's the managing editor, they have done amazing work around, particularly around Indigenous inclusion. And mm-hmm. I don't know any other journal that has an Indigenous editorial circle like these.
Yeah.
They're visionaries, and the journal is remarkable. And yeah. So I've never seen that before. And mm-hmm. I just think, wow, we need more of this. We need more of this. And I did, it was stepping into a void for sure. And if you look at those articles, you probably read mm-hmm. some of them.
I read them all. Well, I didn't read them all, but I looked at them all.
Yeah. And so you'll probably notice like the way that those emerging scholars write and the way that they formulate their ideas, it's very different from the way that mainstream or non-Indigenous scholars formulate their ideas in the journal. Like it's there's plenty of similarities across those Indigenous authored articles. Mm-hmm. And I find that really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, if we hadn't handpicked the peer reviewers, it's possible they might not have gotten through. And yet there are these profound ideas, beautiful, beautiful ideas, and important work that's being reported on. Mm. And it makes me wonder, like, how many papers have been rejected over the years that could have made important contributions, but because someone was too blind to see the value of the work, they just were ignored, you know?
Well, it reminds me of a description of one of the very first articles on homeopathy that was published in a British journal. I don't know if it was Lancet or another, but the authors of the journal said that we had to go through so much scrutiny. We had, and the editor of the journal said, we reviewed this article more than we've reviewed any single article that we've ever published. It had been sent out half a dozen times to a circle of reviewers, and you know, they said, well, you can't say this, you got to say that. And so they did their best to modify what they were writing in order to appease the reviewers, and eventually was published. But that's an idea. When an idea comes along that makes people in positions of power, people in position of authority uncomfortable, then this is what happens. You don't get, your story doesn't get told. I just want to name the journal again, because it's a journal that struck me as well when I first found it. I was told where it was, and I, like a good boy, I went and looked for it. And it's called the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. And that's a very long title, and the acronym is, you have to make up the sound of the acronym. But I mean, agriculture, that's food. Food systems, that's the way you put together the process of preparing, finding, harvesting food. And then community development, it's embedded in the human community. So you take these food production systems and you insert them into our favorite community, the ones we live in, and you say they've got to have a relationship. They have a relationship. I mean, we know they have a relationship, but it's just spelling it out explicitly that I think is the key to this the journal and the work that you did in this particular inaugural column. Does that sound about right?
I would say so. And yeah, and you know, I found the whole experience very meaningful. Like we worked with these emerging scholars for, I don't know, a better part of a year. And it was so great to have these regular meetings and to learn from them and to talk with them and to support them. And you know, I would say the thing that I really like about the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development.
Well done, well done.
Thank you. I did it.
You did it.
The thing I really like about that is they're like Duncan and Amy and the others. It's just like, I don't know, like they're kind of living the world that they want to see in the future. Though I think that's what we do at that journal. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like they're so respectful of people and kind and supportive, and they have such good egalitarian values, and they practice what they preach. I really respect that integrity.
I bet when you get together, you have nice food to eat.
Well, you know, we haven't, I've never met them in person, you know, because.
Well, when they have an editorial board meeting in a room, I hope they have some food.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready for it. That'd be fantastic. I'm ready for it. You know, enough of this online stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to eat your computer. It doesn't taste
Yeah,
good.
that's true.
I
No,
tried. It didn't work. We just got a couple of minutes more, and I just want to offer you one phrase. The centrality of food, place, and learning in indigenous life ways. Would you endorse that statement? I think you probably helped to write it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely would. Everything revolves around food from what I see and from my understanding. And you know, food is everything.
We introduced an author who, with her family in Alaska, lived on local food for a whole year in Alaska with 8 months of winter, and came through it and made a film out of
Wow.
it. And
Wow.
the film is titled First We Eat. In other words, the most central thing to human survival is consuming the wonderful gifts that are available to us,
Wow.
that nourish us and succor us. Keith,
Mm-hmm.
we'll have to end it, but I think we'll probably be talking again. And I want to thank you once again for really articulating and animating the world of Indigenous thought and conceptual ways of looking at things. It's something that probably all of us secretly know we have to get in touch with our inner Indigenous self. But nevertheless, you've done a wonderful job of making it audible. This is radio,
Oh,
after all, to our listeners. Thank you very much for being with us once again.
well, thank you so much, Warren.